Trauma can take a huge toll on human beings. There doesn't even have to be any physical impact for there to be trauma. Our guest this hour has seen trauma of many kinds, from childhood neglect to surviving warfare, and he's convinced that people can heal from trauma. He gives many examples and lays out his techniques in the book, The Transformation, Discovering Wholeness and Healing After Trauma. Dr. James Gordon has a long history in the subject matter of his book. Dr. Gordon is the founder and executive director of the Center for Mind-Body Medicine and a professor of psychiatry and family medicine at Georgetown University Medical School. James Gordon, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff. It's nice to be here with you.
So this book starts fast, disabusing us of the notions that few people get trauma and that it is permanent. What do you find to be the truth on both of those counts?
Well, the fact is the trauma is going to come to all of us if we live long enough. If it doesn't come early in life because of discrimination or poverty or neglect or abuse, as it does to a significant portion of Americans, it's likely to come as we become adults and we deal with the challenges of traumatic situations like divorce or significant disappointment in a job or an educational opportunity or dealing with a physical illness of our own or family members. And in old age, it will come as we become more frail, as we deal with the loss of people we love, and as we face our own death. So I think the crucial thing is not to, we've tended to say trauma just happens to those people that worst, most terrible things have happened. And it's not apart from life. It's a part of life. So that's the first understanding. That's the understanding that that human beings have had for hundreds of thousands of years, as best we can tell, and that we kind of lost it in the modern sort of modern world where we think everything's just supposed to be fine all the time. And the second piece is that those people who have been traumatized have often in the past been given up on. You can see what happened with people soldiers coming back from wars. They've been written off, and for long, long periods of time, many families had somebody who was, quote, never the same after he came back from battle. And I think what I've learned over 50 years of working with people who've been traumatized and working with and on myself is that just about all of us can not only recover from trauma, rebalance the physical and psychological and social imbalances and disruption, but we can also use trauma as the doorway through which we can walk to greater wisdom. And this is the point of the transformation, is to give people very clear, practical, simple, evidence-based techniques of self-care to rebalance themselves after trauma and to discover the truth and the meaning and purpose that to which trauma opens the door. That is, and this is a very ancient understanding, and I'm hopefully bringing it into people in a modern way that's easy for everybody to comprehend.
But, you know, you mentioned ancient practices, and this does go way beyond Western medicine. From where else do you draw some of your practices?
Well, I've trained in Western medicine. I went to Harvard Medical School and had, you know, I'm a board-certified psychiatrist and a researcher at the National Institute of Mental Health. But, you know, there are all these other healing traditions around the world that have somewhat different worldviews, somewhat different ways of understanding and approaching human beings. And the amazing thing is that they seem to work pretty well. And that as we're beginning to bring sort of science to study them, for example, studying the use of acupuncture, we're discovering that they really do have a biological basis and they can have a profound healing effect. So what I've, in my own life, in looking for answers for my own physical and emotional and spiritual challenges, I've not only looked to Western medicine, but I've looked to Chinese medicine, to Indian Ayurveda, to the practices of indigenous healers from Africa, Latin America, Asia, North America. And they've all had something to teach me. And what I've done in the transformation is to bring the wisdom of these traditions together with modern science and created a program which is hopefully as wise as it is scientific for healing trauma. In the ancient world, and also in the world of Greek medicine, which of course is the ancestor of our modern Western medicine, it was understood that there was this process of transformation that people needed to go through when they were dealing with a serious physical or psychological disturbance. And that process, if someone were guided in it, could really result in understandings and ways of being and a kind of wisdom which would change the course of someone's life in a very, very positive way. This is part of Greek medicine, it's part of Chinese medicine, it's part of Indian Ayurveda, and it's part of indigenous healing in pretty much all the systems that I know about. And now, in the West, psychologists are beginning to study this process, and they're calling it post-traumatic growth. So we're beginning to recognize, from our Western scientific perspective, that what the ancients knew and indigenous people have relied on is actually true. It does happen, and it can happen. That door can be open to anyone. And that's the purpose of transformation, not only to heal the damage that trauma has done, but to open that door to all these possibilities of a really new or renewed life.
Dr. Gordon, before we even get to techniques, I have to ask about the pace of progress. How deliberately do you have to work to draw the trauma out while not re-traumatizing people?
That's a great question, and one that does come up. I think that the idea of the approach that I take and that we've taken, really, that I've taken over the last 50 years and the Center for Mind-Body Medicine has taken with very large numbers of people over the last almost 30 years is to allow people to go at their own pace. I know there are some people and some therapies that push people to re-experience the trauma and move through it as quickly as possible. And that can sometimes work for some people. But what I have discovered is that most people really don't want to be pushed too much. They want to be invited to this process. So for some people, it's going to be very fast. And for others, it's going to be much slower. So, for example, kids we've worked with who've been lost family members and maybe family members and homes, and really their whole kind of life situation has been turned upside down in wars, but who've come from fairly stable families and stable societies, often they can move through the trauma fairly quickly. Not because we're pushing them, but because they're young, they're resilient, they have a very good grounding in their family life, they have an extended family they can connect with. But for many of us, especially for people who've been seriously traumatized early in life, it's a much slower process. And it's a matter of using the techniques that I teach, sort of taking them one by one and using them and experimenting and seeing what you discover. And then when you're ready, taking the next step. And I don't, I think there are as many different people as there are just as many different ways to use the transformation and to move through and beyond trauma. But I would really say to people, don't force it. Don't push. Take your time. Just be open to the change. Nature wants us to change. We just have to learn to get out of the way so that we can begin to go through this process of transformation and use the techniques that will make it possible.
So where do you go, for example, with a 9-year-old Palestinian girl who draws a picture of herself dead because she'll be with her father? There's nothing for her in this life. That's an example that you had both in the book and on 60 Minutes.
Yeah, that's Azar. And she's such a beautiful example. She was, we've been working in both Gaza and Israel for about 15 years. We're the only group that's working on a large scale with trauma in both Gaza and Israel. And for Azar, she lost, her father was killed, two uncles and an aunt, her home was destroyed, her whole neighborhood was wiped out. And as you say, when she did her first drawing before she came into her first mind-body skills group, or at the first mind-body skills group with seven other kids who'd also lost their fathers in that 2014 war, the drawing she did was she was the solution to her problem, to having had all these losses and all this sadness, was to be in a grave with her father. The only answer for her was to be killed by Israelis and to die and be reunited with her father. So nobody tried to convince her. The group that she was in was led by a teacher in Gaza, someone we trained. And what we simply did is gave her the opportunity to talk about her feelings. I think one of the problems is people have such difficulty everywhere talking about what's really troubling them. They feel embarrassed or ashamed or unsafe. So she was able to talk about what was going on, and she learned techniques. And then nobody said to her, no, you should feel better. You shouldn't feel that way, Azar. That goes nowhere. I mean, we all know that in our lives. How far somebody said, no, you shouldn't feel that way. Right.
Right.
So, but what we said to her is just, you know, you talk about what's going on. Here's a technique. And then she learned the technique of soft belly breathing, slow, deep breathing in through the nose, out through the mouth with the belly soft and relaxed. Technique I teach early on in the transformation, it balances out the fight or flight response. She was in an anxious, agitated state. She couldn't focus in school. She couldn't sleep. And she, as she does this, she feels calmer. She feels more relaxed. She feels more connected to her body. She gets a little more perspective, because when we're anxious and agitated and overwhelmed, we don't have any perspective on anything. So if she were just stuck in what had happened 5 months ago in the terrible death of her father. And she was, it's like she was still living in that place. Soft belly breathing brought her into the present moment. And she was able to look at things more clearly, to feel that there is an alternative, because in the present moment, she was feeling relaxed and pretty good. So that's the beginning. And then it continued. She learned, again, it's the same techniques that Azar learned are the ones that I teach in the transformation. So she learned how to use mental imagery to imagine that she could be in a safe place instead of feeling so endangered, being in a destroyed house that kept reminding her of what had happened to her father and her family. She could imagine being in a safe place. And so it went. As she learned a whole variety of different techniques, she shared her experience of those techniques with others in the group. She went home and she taught them to her family. So she went from being a girl in despair and hopeless to being a girl who experienced change and who began to hope, a girl who was isolated, because what happens with trauma is that because of its effect on the brain, we don't connect so well with other people. We feel like we're the only ones who've experienced something terrible, even though intellectually we can see that other people have suffered. But the way our mind is working, it feels like we're the only ones. And so after a little while, after doing some of these techniques, Azar could feel a connection with other people, and she could learn from other people, and she could feel their support. So by the end, in her case, it was 3 weeks. It was 9 groups in 3 weeks. By the end, when she drew herself, instead of being this little tiny girl in the corner of a page, little stick figure with her mouth turned down and sadness, she was a big girl in a skirt, and you could see the brown curls. The picture was in bright colors. There was an arrow coming out of her heart, and it was out of her chest, and it was going through a heart she drew on the page. And in the heart, it said, I love nature. She's learning English in school. So she was, and then the arrow was headed to this beautiful tree with all these green leaves on it. And then when she drew the answer, when she drew what she wanted to be or who she wanted to be, instead of drawing herself dead with her father, she drew herself in a white coat with a stethoscope in her ears, with the resonator of the stethoscope on the chest of a figure lying on an examining table. And I said, oh, what's going on, Azar? And she said, I am a heart doctor. This is what I want for myself. I said, well, what are you doing? She said, there are a lot of people in Gaza who've had hurt hearts, and I am going to help them. And then there were 5 other people on the page. And I said, who are these? And she said, oh, those are my other patients. They're waiting for me. So from the image of utter despair, she went to this image of great, not only great hope and great sense of strength and solidity and joy, but also to an image of helping other people. And this is the kind of progress that we regularly see in people who follow the program and the transformation. They balance themselves out psychologically and physiologically, more relaxed. They can look at things more clearly. They're able to connect with other people more easily. They're able to use their imagination. They're able to think about the future. And the future they think about very, very often is a future that has a bigger vision than they ever had before and a more generous vision. They see themselves as kinder, as taking care of other people. This is the essence of what the psychologists are now calling post-traumatic growth. And it happens because we give it the opportunity to happen, because people are able to use the techniques to bring themselves into balance, to open up their minds, to feel greater compassion for themselves first. And then as a kind of natural process, this feeling of connection to other people and of wanting to help other people just grows. And nobody said to Azar, you need to be a good girl, you need to be a doctor, you need to take care of other people. This is all her own discovery.
Dr. James Gordon is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, psychiatrist and trauma expert. His book is called The Transformation, Discovering Wholeness and Healing After Trauma, describes not only his successes in a wide variety of situations in which people experience trauma, but also describes the system he uses. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you talked about the soft belly breathing and that element of quieting the mind, body, and spirit. You say in the contemplative practice, the meditation, if thoughts come, let them come and go. But if they won't leave and raise your anxiety, how do you deal?
Well, you know, the thing, a lot of the anxiety comes from trying to make them go. That's where people get into troubles. We all have, the thoughts are going to keep coming. I think there's a misconception about meditation that we often think that it's the abolition of all thoughts. No more thoughts, clear mind. Well, that happens occasionally. And as soon as you congratulate yourself on it happening, it's gone. The thoughts are back. But the thoughts are going to come, they're going to go. The idea is to relax with that process. And little by little, the thoughts will have less power over you. Now, if you're overwhelmed by thoughts, if you can't just sit comfortably with them, and or even sit with some discomfort with them, but allowing them to come and allowing them to go in their own time, Then what I suggest is you may want to do something physical. You may want to get rid of some of that excess energy first before you sit down and do soft belly breathing. But most people, when they do soft belly breathing, about 70 or 80% of the time, the people begin, the first time they do it, they get some feeling of relaxation, some feeling of calm, some feeling of maybe the shoulders aren't so tight. Or when they open their eyes, the room seems a little brighter, or they feel a little more connected to the chair and to the earth. Now, for those 20% or so who don't, the majority of them will get this feeling the second or third time. So don't push it too hard. Do it for a few minutes. Do it for 3 or 5 minutes. If you feel like I'm so plagued by the thoughts, I can't sit still, then get up, move around, express the thoughts. Write them in a journal. This is another technique that's enormously useful for reducing stress and reducing the sort of nastiness of thoughts that plague us. Or scream them out, shout it out. Just get it outside of you, and then sit down again. Try it again a few hours or another day later. It's a process, and almost always within a day or two, people will come to some state of increased relaxation. And if you can't, if it really doesn't work for you, then I have a whole bunch of expressive meditations that are very, very good for people who have thoughts that plague them. When I first started meditating just about 50 years ago, I started with the active expressive meditations because I couldn't sit still for very long. I was trying to sit still, do a basic Tibetan breathing practice for 40 or 50 minutes, within 10 minutes, I was ready to jump out of my skin. So I started with the expressive meditations, and that's fine. And I describe a number of them in the transformation. One that's very simple is just to stand up with your feet shoulder width and your knees bent and start shaking from your feet up through your knees and chest and shoulders. Just shake for 5 minutes or so and then pause for a couple of minutes and then let your body move to music. And this shaking is one of the oldest kinds of meditation on the planet, and it's very, very effective for decreasing levels of stress and increasing energy. Because sometimes when we're traumatized, we're not just anxious or agitated, but many people after trauma, and I've had this experience myself, some of the time we just don't feel like doing anything. So we need to raise our energy as well as clear our minds.
So the shaking and dancing we're talking about here now, that you shake first and then relax and then move to music. And there are some kinds of music you tend to use. Would you tell us about the choices there?
Well, you know, the music I use is music I love. I mean, I like reggae. I like reggae. I like the beat of reggae. I like the feeling of being connected to the earth. I like the upbeat feeling. But if you don't like reggae, use something else. When I was at, you know, and use something that's inspiring, that's energizing for you. One story I often tell is a few years ago in my private practice, for this third part of shaking and dancing, where I wanted people to have a music that was expressive and energizing for them, there were three women in my practice who didn't know each other at all, but they simultaneously chose the same song for that third part. It was Carly Simon's You're So Vain. Because they were dealing with issues in their relationships, and this helped them get out their frustration and their anger, and it worked for them. So find something that works for you, and use whatever works for you.
We skipped a step. We skipped a step between soft belly breathing, the quieting, and the movement, the shaking and dancing, and that was to draw pictures of hope and healing. Talk about the stages there, because it sounds like they can be quite revealing both to therapists and to people feeling the trauma.
Right. The pictures are a beautiful way to bring out what's inside us, and it's often easier for people to express themselves in pictures than in words. I know many of us are self-conscious about doing drawings because, you know, somebody long ago told us, you're not an artist, that doesn't look good. I had that experience myself when I was a kid. But this is just about putting down whatever wants to come out. So we do, in the beginning, we do a set of three drawings. And anyone can do this. You don't have to be an art therapist to do this. This is a process of your own discovery. The first drawing is draw yourself. Whatever that means, could be stick figures, could be abstract, could be representational, if that suits you. And have I suggest lots of crayons or magic markers so you can use whatever colors come to you. And don't spend too much time, 5 minutes maybe, do that drawing. Second drawing is draw yourself with your biggest problem. And that's, I think, very helpful for most people because they get to focus on something. They may say, oh, I have so many problems. Well, whatever comes out on the page. And lo and behold, 99% of the time, there will be something that will appear. I work a lot with medical students, and so many of them draw clocks, which are menacing them, or they draw prison bars because they feel to them like they're in prison. That's their biggest problem, time pressure, being confined by their education. And then the third drawing is draw yourself with your problem solved. And again, let the imagination do it. It's not a matter of rational thought. And in fact, drawings can often give us answers where hours and days or weeks of rational thought just make us more frustrated. But all of a sudden, something will appear in the drawing. So for example, in that medical student who's feeling overwhelmed and depressed and anxious and feels like, why am I in medical school at all? And then the third drawing turns out to be the student's, she's walking in a park.
Dr. Gordon, I want to move on to emotions. There's a great chapter title here. You say all emotions are innocent. That would indicate that we often feel something else about them.
Well, we live in, I mean, most of us live in a world where emotions are not really welcomed. I mean, there's so much focus on, you know, achieving goals that we have. And in many families, certain emotions are not welcome. If everything's okay and you're feeling good, that's fine. But if you're angry or you're really sad, there are many, many people, many of us have grown up in families where that's not accepted. In my family, it was okay to be angry, but it wasn't really okay to be sad, for example. So, and the thing is, if we suppress those emotions, they tend to take a toll on us. So, for example, people who are feeling frustrated and angry and resentful, who are keeping it inside, are much more prone to develop heart disease and metabolic syndrome and type 2 diabetes, and more likely to become depressed and anxious and so on. So we need to understand that emotions are a part of life, just like trauma. Emotions are a part of life. We all have a range of emotions. And that if we allow them to come, they will leave after a period of time. The problem with emotions is not that we get angry or sad or that we're afraid or anxious. The problem is that we get stuck in that emotion, and it tends to rule our lives. So rather than experiencing the emotion fully and moving through it. And Freud made this point 100 years ago in his famous essay, Mourning and Melancholia. Of course, if you lose someone who's dear to you, you're going to feel enormously sad. The whole world is going to look dark to you for a while. You're going to feel bereft and abandoned. That needs to be honored. And if that is honored by the person who's experiencing it and by the world in which they live, by the social world in which they live, they can move through even the most grievous losses. But if we don't honor it, if we don't allow ourselves to cry and to mourn, then we may well be stuck in that place of sort of unfulfilled mourning. And that's when we tend to get depressed. So it's a question of becoming aware, as I make the point in that chapter in the transformation, becoming aware that there is an emotion there. A lot of time you talk with people, and you say, what are you feeling? And they say, I don't know, because, you know, they've lost track of their feelings. They can tell you what they're thinking. They can tell you what they're doing. So the first part is relaxing, is becoming aware, and then relaxing, and then expressing. Or relaxing, becoming aware, and then expressing the emotion. And it's a continuous circle that can go in any direction. And if we can relax with our emotions, they're not so overwhelming to us. We feel them. We may have a significant sadness. We're aware of the sadness. We feel the sadness. And then we express. Maybe we cry. Or maybe we share what's going on with someone else. And then we move through it. It's amazing how health-giving crying can be, if we allow it to happen. So the chapter is really a kind of coaching session to help people become aware of their emotions, to accept them, to relax with them, and then making a variety of suggestions about ways to express the emotions in drawings and words, with moving the body. All of those can be ways of expressing emotions and bringing them from inside where they're trapped and doing us damage to bringing them outside where they're harmless and they're just out there for us to see as not overwhelming, just a part of us that we're not, you know, that we're not confined by and that we're not ruled by.
So, Dr. Gordon, I have to ask about whom to express emotions to, because I know there are some people who feel like they don't have a safe place to be able to tell somebody about what they're feeling. And you pointed out already that connecting with other people is really crucial support for people who feel traumatized, but we tend to avoid that. So you got a couple of issues here with expressing of emotions and who to express them to, it would seem.
That's a very good point. First place to begin, and this is really where I began when I was a kid, is writing in a journal. You don't have to worry about anybody else. You just write down whatever you feel. It's your journal. Nobody else is going to read it. And it gives you a great sense of relief. And it also helps to prepare the way to express those emotions to other people. So writing in a journal is beautiful. Moving the body physically is a beautiful way to express and release emotions. When I was in Haiti about a year after the earthquake, we went down right after the earthquake and began to work with in Haiti, training local people in the same method I teach in the transformation, and then teaching them how to work with the population. After about a year, I was doing a workshop at the nursing school in Port-au-Prince. And during the earthquake, 90 nursing students had died. One of the buildings had collapsed. And I was doing a workshop with about 100 nursing students. They were all girls, about 18, 19 years old. And they had lost their sisters, their biological sisters, and their close friends. And I got them up. We had an afternoon to do a workshop, and I taught them soft belly breathing, and we did some drawings. And then I got them up shaking and dancing. And we started with fast rhythmic music, and they were shaking their bodies. And within 2 minutes, half the girls were crying. And then they paused. We paused for a couple of minutes and just relaxed and paid attention to the breath and they paid attention to what's going on in their bodies, continued to cry. And then I put on reggae music. I put on Bob Marley's Three Little Birds, Everything's Gonna Be All Right. So the girls are crying, other girls are laughing, they're dancing. When music is over, sit down and I said, what happened? And girls got up and they said, this is the first time we've cried since the earthquake. We lost our sisters, we lost our friends, but we didn't cry because we had to be so strong for our little brothers and sisters, for our parents and our grandparents. We're nursing students. We have to take care of other people. This is the first time we've cried, and it was such a relief to cry. So good. And then other girls said, and this is the first time that we've laughed because we've had to be so serious and take care of everybody. And we haven't laughed and we haven't danced and we're teenage girls and we love to dance. And then one of them said to me, she said, and Jim, we love Bob Marley. We love Bob, but we are Haitian girls and we have wonderful Haitian music. And I said, great. You tell me the Haitian music you think is good, I'll use Haitian music whenever I'm in Haiti. So this is what can happen. These girls were totally shut down, not able to express the emotions at all, not able to really be the wonderful young women that they are, because everything had to be shut down in the name of this idea of having to be strong and take care of everybody else. But once the shaking was able to sort of free up the emotions, they all felt so much better. And they could not only cry, but they could laugh and they could be funny with me and they could joke around with me. But this is the transformation. This is what's possible. This is a way to express emotions. It's a beautiful way. I've seen this literally now, I'm sure, with tens of thousands of people who've been able to express emotions that they've kept shut down doing this shaking and dancing, which I describe in detail in the transformation. So these are ways that you can begin by yourself. And then when you're ready, just like these girls for the first time were ready, once they've loosened up a little, once they feel comfortable themselves with their own emotions, then they were ready to begin to talk about them to somebody else. In this case, me and the 100 other girls who were there in the workshop.
So given the level of trauma that you have dealt with in a lot of cases, you've worked some very tough rooms. You acknowledge that in the book. So a two-part question then. How do you work with the people who are most resistant or most shut down? And then the second part of that question is, how do you not take on some of the sadness and trauma of the people you try to help?
They're good questions. I think the first thing is for the people who are most overwhelmed and most shut down, just sit with them and then offer them these techniques. There's a woman I'm thinking of, I don't think I wrote about her, a woman I met in Kosovo after the war there who had been in a, and her family owned a pizza parlor. And the Serbs massacred, they're Albanian, Kosovo Albanian, Serbs massacred 57 members of her family, including her husband and all but one of her children. And she was totally, she was the saddest, most, I mean, just so overwhelmed, understandably, with this horrible, horrible grief. And I sat with her, and I was just with her, and I did, first of all, I did two things. One is I'd already spent a little time with her son, and I'd encouraged him to play soccer with his cousins, which was very helpful to him. So because she saw something that was helpful, she wanted to talk with me. She wasn't talking to anyone. She was just about mute. And so she and a friend came with me, came to see me together, and sat with her, and I listened. And I was totally overwhelmed by her story. But I knew her friend a little bit, and I said to the friend, what was most helpful to you in all the techniques that, that you learned from our training? These are the same techniques that are in the transformation. And she said, well, I really like the yoga best. And I said, why'd you like it? She said, well, it makes my body more flexible and I feel more calm. And so I said to the woman who'd lost 57 family members, do you think you might do some yoga with your friend? And she sort of, she didn't even say a word. She sort of nodded her head. And that was the beginning. So it's a question of finding where the beginning is. And it's the same with people reading the book. Is look through the book, see if there's a technique, there's an approach that speaks to you, and begin with that one. You can begin wherever it is. There's hundreds of ways to begin the process of healing. So it's a question of patience. It's a question of relaxing, and me relaxing, first of all, and of offering what's possible. And for people reading the book, it's a question of just looking at the book and seeing what strikes you. Don't worry about the things that don't look interesting or don't look like they're going to do any good. Forget about them for now. Come back to them later if you'd like. Find something that does make a difference. And maybe taking a bath, a hot bath. Oh, that feels good. Maybe going for a walk in nature. All of those, any single change, any of the single techniques, any of the tools I describe can be the beginning of the healing process. Now, for me, in these situations, I think it's a question of being as relaxed and meditative as I can be, being totally present with people, feeling what they're feeling, and at the same time, just both allowing that feeling to be there and being present with them. And then when the time is right, offering whatever it is I have to offer and not trying to force anything and not feeling like I have to make something happen. I want to, of course, but I can't force it. And I've learned that over time. So I relax. I allow myself to feel the pain as best I can. I also understand that as much as it may affect me, it's not my loss. It's the other person's loss. So I have some sense of compassion and of connection, but also a sense that the overwhelming grief and the very difficult situation is not the one I'm living in every day. And then the other thing is that when I do feel overwhelmed or I feel like I'm carrying something with me, I do talk to other people. Often when I'm doing this work, I have other members of my team with me. If I'm by myself, then I may talk with somebody on the phone or write a note to somebody who I'm close to, who I know will understand, so I can express myself and just say what's going on with me.
We learned so much in the book. It's called The Transformation, Discovering Wholeness and Healing After Trauma, the work of Dr. James Gordon. Thank you so much for joining us today.